thanks to both to Professor Tessie Hélène and Max Kistler for this kind invitation, and the Collège de France for hosting us to, this afternoon. I'm deeply honored to be here, so I'll try not to disappoint you. So I start with... I start with something that I take to be a fact. There is regularity in nature, and broadly there have been two philosophical stances, both historically and conceptually, one associated with empiricism, the other with rationalism. The first stance takes it that this fact that there is regularity in nature is a basic, ultimate fact. There is no further explanation. If you think of it globally, it's a kind of a cosmic accident. The second position is that this fact, the presence of regularity in nature, is grounded on what I call regularity enforcers, which is, if you like, a metaphysically distinct layer of facts behind the regularity which enforce the existence and operation of regularity. In particular, these regularity enforcers somehow ensure the future extendability of the regularities. Now, empiricists, whom I want to defend in this particular context, adopt one but deny two. So the goal of this talk, which is part of a bigger project, which was left incomplete, I mean to complete it, but the Greek crisis has slowed me down a bit. It's a development of an empiricist metaphysics of laws of nature, where we've got regularities without regularity enforcers, laws without lawmakers of at least a distinct metaphysical kind, and yet a conception of laws which is robust enough and objective enough to satisfy most of us. So the roadmap for this talk, I will argue briefly against stronger metaphysical views. I will outline the empiricist way out. I will outline some steps towards objective, sophisticated regularity view of laws. And this is going to be the most constructive part, clearing the ground for this sophisticated objective view and some more constructive work which has to do with mereology and some quasi-technical material. So I take it that empiricism, when it comes to metaphysics, is kind of characterized by three negative principles. There is no necessity in nature, no necessary connections among distinct existences, no entailment enforcers, no universals as distinct from classes of particulars, no resemblance or similarity enforcers, and no irreducible power in nature, no regularity enforcers. And a question that I've been thinking about the last few years is what kind of constraint do these principles impose on our conceptions of laws of nature? I will, for reasons that will become obvious maybe later on, probably in the discussion period, if they become obvious at all, I will deal mostly with A and C. I'll leave B behind. So there are some good arguments against external necessity. There is this thought which was advanced by William Neal, probably in the early 1950s, that laws are principles of necessitation. When it was advanced, people took it more or less that Neal was crazy. How could he possibly think about a non-human conception of laws? Later on, this position was revamped by Armstrong, Dretschke, and Tooley. Relations of necessitation among properties qua universals. There is this fellow N, which is supposed to... be a lawmaking relation among properties F-ness and G-ness, or being F and being G. F-ness necessitates G-ness, and this is supposed to be an external lawmaking relation. N is an external regularity enforcer. It does not flow from the nature of the universals. It is a worldly add-on. You can have the universals without the N, but as a matter of fact, there is this lawmaking relation. So N, this lawmaking relation, is contingent, yet it's supposed to entail the corresponding regularity for all x, fx implies gx, all ravens are black. And the question that has exercised many serious thinkers in the last 20 years, how can that be? How can N be both an external contingent relation among properties and an entailment enforcer? In particular, the issue is how can we get regularities out of this necessitating relation? And there is some toing and froing in the history of this debate, but the settled view somehow that the regularity holds because of the necessitating relation between F and G. So N should be such that it enforces that F and G are always constantiated, but that there is a contingent relation between two properties does not imply on its own that whenever F-ness is instantiated, so is G-ness. For instance, being a bird and flying, there is a contingent relation between them. The two properties are not always constantiated. Penguins or birds kept in a cage who can fly do not. The moral, the claim all Fs are Gs because of this necessitating relation holds, provided that N necessitates or entails that all Fs are Gs, but this is question begging. There is no independent reason to think why this is so. There is another view which was formed after, if you like, people started to realize the failures of this external lawmaking relation. The idea that necessity in the world is immanent, not external. It's part of its basic metaphysical structure. The nature of the properties, the essences of natural kinds and the like somehow dictate necessary connections. So here there is no external lawmaking relation in the world. The properties themselves are enough for the necessary connections. They are the lawmakers. Properties are immanent regularity enforcers. That's the claim, and the question is, how can this be? And the answer that many people nowadays, some of them are, most of them are first-rate philosophers, a lot of them are friends of mine, but we disagree on this, properties are modally laden powers, okay? So the properties are full of, they are carriers of modality. Now, if you think of it, this simply transfers the problem of the alleged necessity of laws to a different territory, properties, powers, dispositions, essences, and the like. There are many arguments against powers. Some of them are good, some of them are really bad, like the first one. Somehow it's an epistemological argument. I'm going to say a couple of words on argument number three in this context. The claim is supposed to be that powers ground the regularity there is in nature, but that's too quick. They don't. Powers might explain why things tend to behave in certain ways, yet tending to behave does not entail actual behavior, and it's consistent with any actual behavior whatsoever. So powers in and of themselves do not explain actual behavior. When I was thinking about that, I was reading recently, and I put that thing on the blackboard down there about Alexander's bird, a fairly recent attempt somehow to show how by taking properties to be powers, the power entails some disposition, and the disposition entails some manifestation. If this is a counterfactual condition all over here, if X was in stimulus conditions S, there would be the manifestation M, and he claims this somehow grounds or explains the regularity for all X when the X has the property P and is in stimulus conditions S, then you've got the manifestation. That's easy and nice, but it occurred to me that's all Carnap already back in 1937. Carnap, one of the ways he introduced dispositions like temperature was by this device without the necessity operator, of course, and that's totally neutral on the status of properties. If you think that temperature, for X to be in temperature T implies if it were to put, or if it is put in contact with a thermometer S, then this reading is going to be on the thermometer, then of course you've got the regularity, but that's totally neutral with respect to the modal status of the disposition. It's fully consistent with the thought that the disposition is actually reduced to a categorical property, so I don't see how you can get any mileage out of this way to introduce dispositions. And of course, the friends of powers and the friends of metaphysically heavyweight conceptions of laws have problems among themselves because it's not quite clear whether in the end there are or there are not laws. If the lawmaking relation is an internal relation, is there really need to posit it as opposed to the properties themselves? Why not stay with the properties and have the lawmaking relation be just a summary of the fact that there are necessary connections among distinct and separate properties? And here there are two views. One is the dominant, held by Sawyer, Bird, Ellis, among other people. Laws are just summaries of relations among modally laden powers, but there is a minority view. There are no laws at all, just modally laden powers, held by Stephen Manford. So it's unclear whether there are laws anymore, and if they are, what exactly they are supposed to do over and above the modally laden power that the properties already possess. It seems to me, and that's not an argument, I mean, in a sense that I'm trying to undercut some of the arguments in favor of a stronger position, the cleanest way out is to go the empiricist way, take the view that laws are contingent, and the motivation behind this is the thought that the world does not have to be the way it is, it just is. No further metaphysical facts or principles enforce the way it is and make it impossible for it to be otherwise. Hence, laws are contingent. They are, but they might not or could not be. Now, that's a critical point. Denying the existence of enforcers, entailment, similarity, regularity, does not imply that anything goes. This might be something that the friends of powers feel. Denying the existence of enforcers implies that laws are contingent, that is not metaphysically necessary, they do not have a grounding in metaphysically distinct layers of fact. It does not, emphatically, it does not imply that there are no non-trivial actual relations between the regularities there are in the world, that there are no actual objective relations of similarity and difference in the objects of in the world. So I've been trying to motivate what is normally called the regularity views of laws. This is a neo-Humean empiricist approach which advocates a sparse metaphysical view of the world according to which there are irreducible regularities in nature. The slogan is regularities all the way down, which involve, and that's a point that I want to explain in this talk in a few minutes, patterns of dependence among members of natural classes, also known as natural properties, and which patterns underpin the causal and generally modal relations there are between them. Hence, if you take this view, you deny the need for an additional lawmaking relation of a distinct, and I insist on that, metaphysical type, a regularity enforcer. Now, conceptually and historically, again, there are two versions of this regularity view of laws. So-called naive, apparently that's a philosophical term of art, okay? Naive means we don't like it, but doesn't necessarily mean it's not a good position. Naive is that there is no need for a lawmaking relation. Simplicity, laws are regularities and regularities are laws. Now, this has got some appeal, but it fails to distinguish between laws and accidents. Not all regularities and laws are laws. There are some examples. It's very difficult to find serious examples of supposed accidents in the literature. So people come up with all coins in my pocket are euros or things like that. And there are some more serious ones, But in any case, there is a distinction between laws and accidents, and presumably not all regularities can be laws. So the response to this is to add a differentia, this infamous X, and to be sophisticated regularity view of laws, advocate not all regularities are laws, so laws are regularities plus X, and the important issue is what this X is. X should not be of a distinct metaphysical type, should be something acceptable to empiricists and does not somehow sneak in heavyweight metaphysical conceptions, the enforcers I was talking about. Within the sophisticated regularity view of laws, there are two, if you like, positions available, the subjective, sophisticated RVL. This X is a broadly subjective feature of the inquirer's attitude towards regularities. So to say something a law is basically to give to it a kind of an honorary distinction, if you like to call someone a lord. It's different attitude towards this regularity. I'm not going to go into that. There is an objective, sophisticated regularity view of laws, where presumably X is supposed to be a broadly objective feature of the world. And the challenge is, can this objective, sophisticated RVL be had without enforcers? Now, it seems to me there are good ways to deny the charge of subjectivism when it comes to regularities. It's important to draw a distinction between what I call regularity objectivism and power realism. Sometimes these are conflated. The view that regularities are objective in the sense that they would continue to hold in the world even if there were no minds available, I think that's something many people like myself would hold on to, regularity objectivism. What we would deny is power realism, the view that there is regularity in the world because of the causal powers in the objects, because of regularity enforcers. So the objective sophisticated version I want to defend denies power realism. It does not deny regularity objectivism. And I remind you of what I said before, positing powers does not ipso facto yield regularities. There could be powers or forces or whatever without there being any regularity in the world. So power realism needs independent motivation. And the question is, isn't there obvious independent motivation for power realism? And the obvious independent motivation is a very typical philosophical move. That the view I want to defend, the objective sophisticated RVL, leaves unexplained something that requires explanation, the existence of regularity in nature. So presumably there must be an explanation of the existence of regularity. The answer here is that when it comes to explanation, we need to admit unexplained explainers anyway. So positing an extra layer of ontically distinct facts behind or below, not quite spatial metaphors, but you see what I mean, the regularities, will itself be an unexplained explainer. The question, what explains the regularity, will be just pushed back. What explains the productive relation or whatever? Why are there powers at all? And that's one of the very few things I can actually agree with Wittgenstein, but he said in the Philosophical Investigation, a nothing could serve just as well as a something about which nothing could be said. Okay, so let's stay with the regularities and forget about something like the extra metaphysical layer of power. It's not quite right that nothing can be said of this, but I think there are good arguments against powers anyway. The bottom line is that one supposed mystery, the presence of regularity in the world, is not explained by positing another mystery, the presence of a modal force in the properties. Is this a thin metaphysics of laws? Now, of course, it's thinner than one that explains or grounds the regularity in terms of necessary connections and the like, but it seems to me it's not thin enough. I mean, it's not. There can be further regularities that ground regularities, you know, more fundamental regularities somehow grounding less fundamental or high-level regularities. So there can be further reasons why specific regularities hold. There is no reason why there is regularity in the world, simpliciter, but there are reasons why Kepler's laws hold, and this is Newton's laws, etc., etc. So the right answer, the presence of regularities in nature, can be explained by appeal to other more fundamental and, in this sense, deeper regularities. The world consists of regularities all the way down. This is its metaphysical blueprint. Now, there is a question that has bothered me for quite some time now, and it's what is a regularity? From a metaphysical point of view, if we try to think of a regularity sub specie aeterni, as it were, what I want to claim is that a regularity R is constituted by the sum S of its instances, where instances at other times and at other places are temporal and spatial parts of the regularity. This will be explained in a minute. But further on, a regularity R is not identical with the sum S of its constituent instances. And that's an old chestnut, constitution versus identity, the statue and the lump of clay that is made of. Are they one and the same? The Aphrodite of Milo, you've got in the Louvre, which is a marvelous statue. Is it identical to the lump of clay it contains it? It contains or not? A claim that I want to defend here generally is that R, the regularity or something, is constituted by its parts, but it's not identical to the sum of its parts, because the two things, the regularity and the sum of its parts, might have different persistence conditions. So the lump of clay might lose a bit of its parts. So Aphrodite of Milo, Venus of Milo, has no right or left hand. Okay, it's still the same statue. Okay, I mean, I think we feel it's the same statue. It's a marvelous statue nonetheless. Whereas if somehow we undid it, whatever that means, it would no longer be a marvelous statue. So I'm going to skip the rest, and I'm going to introduce you very quickly to some elements of Mereology. Mereology is the part of logic, if you like, which studies the relations between the whole and the part. It's a very, very simple, if you like, but very powerful theory or logic. You need just one basic relation, is a proper part of, and there are three axioms, actually two, irreflexivity, asymmetry, and transitivity. If you've got asymmetry and transitivity, you've got irreflexivity. If A is part of B and B part of C, then A is part of C. If A is part of B, then it's not the case that B is part of A. But then there is an extra principle which is called weak supplementation, and if a whole has a proper part, it has also another proper part that is disjoint from the first. So a whole should have at least two disjoint parts, okay, if it has one. Now, that's something which might sound irrelevant to what is going to follow, but I assure you that it's not. You all know nowadays if you do that, actually, you got the smiley anyway in your computer. If you do these symbols, you get the happy face, okay, for free. This is smiley, let's call it R, and it's got constituent parts, and the constituent parts are this, the hyphen, two dots, and the right hand bracket, and there is a special arrangement, of course, and we can call S the sum of these parts. Now, I claim that the smiley is not identical with this sum, though it's constituted by S, by this sum. They coincide spatially, if you like. So if you do not have the sum or these parts, you would not have R. But intuitively, and I insist on the intuitively, there is more to R than the unity of elements in their spatial relations. And what is this more? Is the meaning you want to convey when you do these things, okay? The smiley face meaning, okay? Don't take this meaning very, very seriously, but the idea that somehow you convey some extra information by when you arrange these things over there. And of course, the meaning, the smiley, has different persistent conditions with respect to the constituents. If you think of it, if you see this thing, it's chopped off a bit here. So actually, there's some bits, some molecules of this have been chopped off. Okay, so that's not quite the same when it comes to the constitution, but it's the same smiley, one could argue. So is mereology defined if we take this line? The constituent parts in their spatial relation, S is a proper part of R, and there is another proper part of R that is not a constituent part of R. So we've got the weak supplementation principle. What is this proper part, the disjoint proper part, which is not a spatial constituent of smiley? It is not a special part of R. If it were, it would have to be a constituent part of this. It is a supervening entity. It is the smiling meaning, as we would say colloquially, which is a proper part of smiley, a supervening entity. Let's call this extra part W. So smiley R actually is the sum of S, the spatial constituents, plus this W. R is the mereological sum of its parts. Therefore, weak supplementation principle is satisfied, even though it is, in some colloquial sense, more than the sum of its constituent parts. You might say, why all this is relevant? Before I say that, I was reading recently a marvelous book by a lady called Koslicki or something like that, which is absolutely marvelous. And she reintroduces this idea of form. So there is not just matter in the world, there is form in the world. So objects have formal components as well as material components. Formal components could be taken to be the shape, for instance, a proper part. And an object is the sum, sorry, the sum, not this sum, but this S-U-M sum, of its material and formal parts. Therefore, we've got weak supplementation being satisfied. Here's the connection then. The regularity, I claim, is the mereological sum of its parts, and yet it is more than the sum, in the colloquial sense, of its constituent instances. It has excess content, as it were. And a regularity is constituted by its spatio-temporal instances, yet it's not identical with them. There could be no difference in the regularity without a difference in its instances. Let's call S the totality of the instances or parts of the regularity. The regularity, it's not identical with S. Why? There is, I claim, another proper part of R, which is not a constituent part of R. We call it P. So the regularity is actually the sum of the instances plus P. What is this P? I claim it is the pattern that unifies or is present in the regularity. I'm very easy going about the constituent parts of a regularity. The constituent parts of a regularity, or the instances, as we colloquially say, of a regularity, I treat them as synonymous, are the objects that fall under the regularity with their properties. So a black raven is a constituent part of the regularity, all ravens are black. The orbit of the Earth around the Sun is a constituent part of the regularity, that the Earth moves around the suns, or even that all planets describe ellipses. A neutron decaying is a part of a regularity. So presumably these are the ravens, okay, and then there is a regularity in them, there is a pattern in the regularity, namely the instantiation of the blackness, if we put it colloquially, and that's a regularity also, a planet going around the sun. When it comes to pattern, it struck me that there is very meager philosophical literature on this issue. Resnick wrote a book, Mathematics as the Science of Patterns. He takes it more or less that patterns are structures, one or more objects that stand in various relations. Dennett wrote a famous article on patterns, real patterns, but you don't get much information about what a pattern is. He talks about a pattern existing in some data is real if there is a description of the data that is more efficient than the bitmap, whether or not anyone can concoct it, if we can compress the information, if you like, there is in the pattern. You don't get much out of the otherwise lovely book written by Lademann and Ross when they talk about real patterns. Even in pattern theory in mathematics, they don't define pattern. They say more or less, I mean, everybody knows what a pattern is. Okay? I mean, really. Okay? You know what a pattern is. So I take what I call out of naivete and intuitive view. It's a repeatable and recurring network of similarities and differences among entities, one or more objects standing in repeatable and recurring similarity relations to each other. And we can distinguish between static patterns, a black raven, a chessboard, or a meander, or dynamic patterns evolving over time, the motion of a planet around the sun, etc., etc. Now, all this is still quite exploratory for reasons that I explained earlier on, but what you can get out of patterns is ideas like patterns may occur within other patterns, sub-patterns. There can be higher level patterns, that patterns can be abstract, and of course concrete arrangements may instantiate abstract patterns. So there is some useful philosophical work to be done if this is properly explored by the notion of the pattern. But when it comes to the regularity, why I think this introduction of the pattern beyond the instances is important, there are two broad reasons. The instances of the regularity, I claim, fall under a pattern. The regularity displays the unity of a pattern. Why is that? The persistence conditions of the regularity include the stability and persistence of a pattern. The pattern may be thought of as the form of the regularity, what we would normally call the blackness of the raven, or the elliptical form of the orbit of the planet, or the inverse square form of the relation between massive bodies. And I'll explain that a little bit more by saying that a regularity and the sum of its instances have different persistence conditions. That's why I think they are distinct objects, if you like. What I mean by that is that the regularity, say, take the regularity or ravens are black, would remain even if a raven was missing. If some bad guy killed one or a few, the regularity would still remain, since the pattern, that is the blackness among the ravens, would remain. So, and that's something that I need to explore so we can discuss it or you can press me on this, but my claim would be that the pattern in the regularity could be seen as the locus of the modal force the regularity has, something which sounds safe for an empiricist. Given the pattern, if there was another raven, it would be black. Okay? Let me say quite quickly that I'm trying to do metaphysics. I'm trying to think of a pattern sub specie aeterni, not how we come to know, realize, or whether there is a pattern. That's a serious issue, of course, and I don't want to underestimate it, but I'm trying to think of a regularity sub specie aeterni and see what in the world would be for it to contain an irregularity. And there is this principle of unrestricted. Am I doing okay on time?
Yes. Yes.
15 minutes and also we have quarter of an hour left.
Yes. Do I have five more minutes,
yes, you
roughly?
Have five, okay. Five more minutes. Yes.
All right. So there is this famous principle of unrestricted restricted composition. There is some controversy about that. The idea is that any set of objects creates a whole. So I'm in Paris myself. At the tip of the Eiffel Tower, and Notre Dame, and Claudine. You've got another object, okay? And of course, you've got millions of other objects. And it's a famous statement of this by David Lewis, and a famous chimera, a trout turkey. A trout turkey is an object which is half trout, half turkey. Presumably this is allowed by the unrestricted composition principle. Whenever there are some things, no matter how many or how unrelated or how disparate in character they may be, they have a mereological sum. Lewis says that's fine, existence is one thing, queerness is another. That's a queer thing, but nonetheless it exists. So there are plenty of objects because there is abundance of mereological sums. And then, of course, Lewis tries to take some of the unintuitive appeal of this by saying unhomogeneous, disconnected, and in not contrast with its surroundings, this object, the trout turkey, it is not cohesive, not causally integrated, not a causal unit in its impact on the rest of the world. These are reasons to disallow its being a natural, if you like, object, not being unreal. And the claim here would be that not all mereological sums are regularities. The unity of the pattern is necessary. A regularity should display the unity of a pattern, that is, a pattern of repeatable and recurring similarities among its instances. So I left that blank because I wanted to say something, but we'll discuss that. So that's important because there are people who say, no, composition should not be unrestricted. There should be restrictions, okay? And I tend to be persuaded by Koslicki and other people that this should be so. I thought I had put a few things up there, but I haven't. So what kind of animal is a regularity? Now, a regularity, I think, is best conceived as what metaphysicians, hardcore metaphysicians, call a perduring entity, since it cannot be said to be wholly present in different regions and different times. That is, a regularity has temporal and spatial parts. We conjoin that with eternalism, the view that past and future objects and times are no less real than the present ones. And this might well make possible to think of the regularity in a sort of timeless way, sub specie aeterni. Of course, you all know that, George Orwell, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. How do we distinguish between laws and accidents? Laws are regularities, but some regularities are more equal than others, and this is what we call laws. Again, here I'm exploring. So not all regularities are laws of nature. Which regularities are laws? What is the missing differentia X we've been looking for? We should think of in terms of natural patterns. I'll say a couple of words on this, that the patterns interlock, they should create a network. But nonetheless, there is no pattern enforcer or of a distinct metaphysical type, since there can be relations among patterns and constraints imposed. Why naturalness? Natural patterns involve natural properties, hence need for natural properties or classes that are distinguished from each other by objective sameness and difference in nature. But of course, famously, this notion of naturalness is hard to define. It's, I take it, an unanalyzed yet indispensable primitive. And I subscribe to the Lewisian view that the inventory of perfectly natural classes or properties is or will be delivered by fundamental physics in the end. Why a network? A fact about the world, I take it, it is a fact about the world that the regularities form objectively a system, that is, the world has an objective regularity structure in which regularities stand in certain relations to each other. How can this be? Recall what I said above, patterns may occur within other patterns. I don't have a formal theory, but we all know, for instance, that an ellipse belongs to a larger pattern, which we call a conic section, and the circle, the ellipse, the parabola, and the hyperbola. And then using these patterns, you can actually describe various orbits of objects around a massive body like the sun, and you can actually claim when one pattern is a limiting case of another pattern, like a circle of an ellipse, etc., etc. So I think that's my last slide. The regularity is the mereological sum of its parts, and laws are those regularities that are characterized by the unity of a natural pattern. Thank you.